Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolsky. I got my co-host, Dr. Carl, who I say is the greatest endocrinologist to walk the planet. And today we have a couple of special guests. We finally got my buddy on here, Dr. Kevin Hall, the greatest physicist in all the land, greatest nutrition researcher. He couldn't come on before because he was part of the NIH, but he is not there anymore. So he agreed to come on our podcast this go around. And he is here with his co-partner here, Julia Belluz, who is a great writer. I love her stuff. And she used to write for The Vox, but now New York Times. So we're going to be talking about their book together, Food Intelligence. That's the name of the book, right? And now I remember talking about with you what you guys are going to name the book. So it was really cool to see this finally come together. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Spencer.
All right. I want to hear, like, what was the process of, like, starting this? Why did you write this book? I mean, we could give a little bit of background about you. You're known as the Biggest Loser study guy. We can get into that. Everybody knows that. And
not everyone knows that. I think.
Well, okay. We'll talk about it.
We should eventually.
But I assume the reason you wrote this book was kind of dispel some of those myths and talk about it. Or I didn't read the book yet. You sent me a copy. I haven't read it yet.
Oh, you what a jerk. Slacker.
I know.
Slacker,
what a jerk.
Spencer.
You are.
Yeah, maybe I'll start. I mean, one of the things that has been always a little bit frustrating being at the NIH as a scientist is that we don't often get a chance to kind of speak directly to the public, right? We give our talks at conferences, we talk to reporters, and especially with the Biggest Loser study, one of the things that was particularly frustrating was, despite what I thought was a pretty clear, you know, documentation in the papers that we wrote about it, almost every reporter got, you know, they got some of it right when they reported it, but they kind of missed the overall picture, and they flipped like causality. They basically were saying that, you know, slowing of metabolism was determining, you know, why people couldn't lose weight, why the people who had the greatest slowing would be most at risk for weight regain. And therefore the folks who are going to be the most successful are going to not have the slowing of metabolism. And in fact, you know, I think we were pretty clear in the papers that that's not the case. And yet, you know, we didn't have the ability to just kind of talk directly to the public and say, you know, that's not the way it is. And so, you know, that was one of the motivations to kind of have the venue to just really communicate directly with folks who were obviously really interested in this research. You know, I kept hearing people reporting it wrong. you know, we just wanted to have the opportunity to not just dispel the myths around the Biggest Loser study. Obviously, that's just, you know, the first chapter of the book. But just generally speaking, people are confused about what we know and what we don't know about metabolism and nutrition science. And they're often very confused and being told very conflicting stories by, you know, various wellness influencers. And they're generally confused and distracted from what really matters, both the really interesting science that we've learned about and are continuing to learn about, as well as what to do about, you know, the current status of diet-related chronic disease that we're all sort of battling. And yeah, so that was kind of the broad scope of things that we hope to tackle in the book.
And so, Julia, just to be clear, Spencer, I want to make sure. So you're telling me that media headlines, other than maybe from Julia, have somehow misconstrued and miscommunicated. So your media headlines have miscommunicated the science? I can't imagine,
huh?
Wait, because Julia, I know you wrote a whole series on his work a few years back, right?
I covered many of Kevin's studies, but I did even get the Biggest Loser. I think, yeah, the top line in the Biggest Losers. I think some pieces I had, I didn't obviously intentionally report them inaccurately, but I realized that I think many of us have preconceived notions about things, obviously, and we kind of jam evidence into these preconceived notions. And I think it's such a ubiquitous idea that one reason many people struggle with weight is because the body fights back when you start to lose body fat. And it's this slowing of metabolism that happens that must make it harder. And so the big kind of top line findings from that, from the 6-year follow-up Kevin study did was, I think people regain 2/3 of the lost body weight, right?
Yeah.
On average, right. on average.
Yeah.
And then you see this big, this metabolic slowdown that they have persisting. And so it seemed, you put these two things together and it seems to like, well, obviously that's what was happening. And I think I did that a little bit in my story. Others did it maybe even more prominently. And yeah, but that's obviously not what the research showed.
Yeah.
I think one thing, like Kevin, with his training as a physicist, he's really interested in these fundamental questions, right? About, yeah, what is matter made of, and you know, how do things really work? And I had an interest in similar questions, and we were hoping with this book to really step back from the diet wars and get at, you know, what are the macronutrients? What are they doing in the body? What is metabolism actually? All these things we take for granted. So we're hoping to communicate this fascinating science in the book, although there is a lot of debunking along the way for sure.
Good, because there are a bunch of idiots saying a lot of stupid things online, and we need people like Kevin to lay the smack down and people like Julia to translate it into a lower level reading for everybody to understand instead of geniuses like Kevin.
Yes. This was a big part of the process though, because Kevin would say things, although you're actually an extremely clear communicator as far as scientists go, I must say, but sometimes it was, okay, wait, what do you really mean by that? Can you explain it again for the 16th time? And you would do it patiently every time. I was very impressed by that.
It's complicated. I mean, I will say, kind of like, you know how we see these press conferences with Trump and all his little minions and stuff just kind of sit there and compliment him like it's like some other weird authoritarian country. I kind of feel like that's how we have to be to Kevin, because, you know.
Well, yeah, you better be.
It's complicated. This is complicated stuff. But to your credit, just like what Julia said, when we listen to you speak on these studies at conferences, it always makes sense when you're talking about it. And then it does get a little bit more like, wait, how do I say that too? But you do have a great job of communicating. So it's really nice to be able to get a book out there with your words in it too.
Just a little quick how I met Kevin. It was back, I don't know, it was 2015 or 14-ish when you had that first initial study looking at insulin responses from carbohydrates versus fat, I think. It was the first pilot study that was done, and it came out, and Yoni Friedhoff knew you at the time, and I was like, hey, do you know this guy? I see you know this guy. I need to meet him. I was just moving to Maryland for the first time. And you invited me to your office and at the NIH and showed me around the metabolic ward. It was so cool to see. This is where people stay for a while to show their metabolism and how many calories they're burning and how the metabolic kitchen makes all this. So I always appreciate that. And then we shared pizza and all that stuff. And I had a Bloody Mary at one point. And
okay.
It was sounds about right.
Okay. All right, so getting back to the biggest loser thing. So, you know, we don't want to go over the whole book because you want to leave the listeners wanting to buy this right away. And everybody should go buy this because I'm going to be recommending it to all of my patients.
But first, you have to read it. You have to read it.
Yeah. I don't even need it. And I know. Just hand it, give it to me so I can read it and then tell my patients. What a jerk.
I'm always messaging him, talking. We're talking back and forth all the time. It's really good.
Yeah, you're like, help you don't me. Read.
No, it's just, I need the cliff notes, okay? I need the cliff notes. But going back to the biggest, so can you talk just a little bit about, like, because your thing is the whole metabolic adaptation. And I always explain it the way that you've explained it to me. But I bet there's probably a better way to explain metabolic adaptation, and then talk about what happened to these Biggest Loser patients, and then talk about what happens to like most everybody in terms of metabolic adaptation that aren't at these extreme levels. Could you just say, kind of explain it a little bit?
What does it all mean, sure. Basil?
So maybe I'll start with just the general thing that a lot of people, you know, even to this day still seem confused about, which is just this notion that people who have obesity or people who are larger, they actually have faster metabolic rate, right? So they're burning more calories in total than a leaner person. And that's, you know, for a variety of different reasons. And that's both kind of when they're moving around their day-to-day life, because it costs more energy to kind of move around larger bodies. But also just when they're resting, their resting metabolic rate is also higher than a smaller person. And the biggest contributor, if you were to just kind of try to come up with a mathematical equation to say, okay, well, does body fat contribute as much as fat-free mass, which is basically everything but body fat? The answer is no. There's like very different coefficients there. And it turns out that it's the fat-free mass, this the non-body fat component of your body that's burning the most calories per kilogram, and your fat burns relatively little. But of course, your fat-free mass is lots of other things, right? It's all your different organs, it's, you know, your muscle and whatnot. And it's kind of an average of all of those different things. And so one of the things that I thought was really interesting about the biology of weight loss was that it has been known for, you know, more than a century that when people cut calories in their diet, either they're fasting entirely for many days at a time, or they're cutting a lot of calories like was done in the Minnesota starvation experiment back in the 1940s, is that the metabolic rate will go down because people are getting smaller, but it will go down even more than you'd expect based on how much fat they lose and how much fat-free mass they lose. And that difference between the expected amount of slowing and the actual measured amount is what people call metabolic adaptation. It's the adaptation to that lower amount of calories that they're eating and the fact that they're then losing weight. And so one of the questions that people have had for a long time is kind of was one of the main reasons I was really interested in the Biggest Loser contest, is that there was this notion that, well, if you just got people to exercise enough and they could prevent that loss of fat-free mass, in particular, they could maintain their skeletal muscle, then maybe you wouldn't see the slowing of metabolism to the same extent. Maybe that would help with weight loss and make it easier for people. And so, you know, actually designing a study like that, where you actually got people who had obesity and they were losing weight and getting them to exercise a lot, you know, would have been a really hard study to do, but there was this crazy television program that was actually doing it and had been doing it for many seasons before we got involved. And so the kind of first fundamental question that I was interested in was, well, was this true? Could you actually prevent the slowing of metabolism if people did enough exercise? And it was pretty clear they were doing enough exercise and different kinds of exercise, you know, resistance training, aerobic training, everything in between, cross training and whatnot. And so that was the basic idea for the first study, was let's just get some metabolic measurements on these folks, both resting and total energy expenditure, measure their body composition, how much of their weight loss is coming from fat mass versus fat-free mass. And we could answer this question, you know, what's going on with metabolic adaptation in this particular case? With the prediction that maybe if the mantra of the kind of fitness folks was right, that they did enough exercise, they could prevent the fall of metabolism, we should be able to detect that. And what we found was exactly the opposite, right? We found this huge reduction in the number of calories people were burning at rest after we accounted for how much fat-free mass and fat mass that they lost. And they were able to preserve their fat-free mass quite a bit. You know, the vast amount of the weight loss, more than 80%, was coming from fat mass, which was great. Like, that's much more than you would get with kind of similar amounts of weight loss with bariatric surgery, for example. But despite that, they were still, their metabolic rate was slowing down much more than would be expected. And the hidden piece of that, which was kind of interesting at the time, but didn't get a lot of, that first study didn't get hardly any press at all. Like, most people pretty much ignored that first study. But a couple of things were kind of interesting that we reported. One was that the folks who had the greatest slowing of metabolism were also the ones who lost the most weight. And the differences between people in terms of how much exercise they did didn't predict how much weight they lost relative to each other. But those who cut the most calories in their diet lost the most amount of weight. And so the relative comparison between cutting calories in your diet and physical activity in terms of explaining the differences in weight loss between the people in the competition was that the calories cut in the diet explained most of it. Differences in physical activity didn't explain the differences. And people who were most successful at losing weight had the greatest slowing of metabolism. So that part was a little surprising, right? Because if anything, you think if you're burning fewer calories, you should be less successful at losing weight. And here was an example where the opposite was true. But nobody misreported it because no one covered that study. The question that we were interested in then was, okay, well, maybe the people who had the greatest slowing of metabolism are most likely to regain the lost weight, right? Nobody expected that these folks would be able to maintain this crazy level of physical activity or this crazy cutting of calories, which was insane, like 65% calorie reduction for months on end, and increasing the amount of exercise they were doing by an average of 3 hours of vigorous exercise a day on the ranch and 1 hour a day every day of the week when they went home. So crazy amounts of lifestyle intervention, not sustainable by any stretch of the imagination. So the question was, maybe the people who had the greatest slowing of metabolism would regain the most weight. And when we did the study 6 years later, there was actually no relationship whatsoever. It was completely no correlation between the slowing of metabolism at the end of the weight loss period and who regained the most amount of weight. But the surprise was the folks who had regained the least amount of weight, in other words, had been most successful at keeping the weight off, at 6 years continued to experience the greatest slowing of metabolism. So same sort of thing, that at both during the weight loss phase and 6 years later, the most successful people are the ones who boast the slowest metabolisms. And that's what practically every reporter got wrong in describing the study. And in fact, claimed almost the opposite, that it was the slowing of metabolism that was responsible for people regaining the weight. And in fact, the direction of that we could see in the correlations was exactly the opposite.
How much percentage wise was there, was the metabolic adaptation like 10, 20, 30% lower than expected?
So I think it was averaging somewhere around 400 calories per day, more than was expected on average. Now I'd have to kind of go back and remember what the total resting energy expenditure was, which I don't off the top of my head, but that sort of 400 calories per day, 300 or 400, that's, you know, a decent size, you know, meal or so, or certainly a big snack. And so that, again, was the logic, like, okay, well, if they're burning that many fewer calories, surely they're the ones who are going to have the least success at keeping the weight off. But the way we sort of think about it now is not that the slowing of metabolism is determining the outcome. It's that whatever you're able to successfully accomplish in terms of changing your lifestyle, your metabolism responds to that. In the same sort of way, the analogy I like to use is kind of if you're pulling on a spring, right? And you kind of have the spring and it's completely relaxed, and you're not pulling on it at all, it's not stretching. As soon as you start to stretch the spring, you're putting a certain amount of effort into stretching the spring and it gets extended, and that the extension of the spring might be like your weight loss. And the more you pull on the spring, the greater the tension on the spring. And the tension is kind of like the metabolic adaptation. So the further you stretch it, because you're putting in more effort, there's a greater pullback, but there's also greater success in stretching the spring. And so the metabolic adaptation is like that resistance. If it wasn't there, sure, for the same amount of effort, you would have been able to pull it way further. But it's not the determinant in how much weight you're losing. It's a response to how much weight you're losing. And unless you change the fundamental biology by like changing the tension on the spring, it's not going to be a determinant of how much weight is lost.
And what's causing that?
Great question.
Yeah.
Oh boy. I don't think we know the answer to that question. Yeah. I mean, still to this day, I mean, it's really interesting that we can measure metabolism at a sort of whole body level. And we know one of the things that we kind of talk about in the book is that, you know, it's really distracting to think about metabolism solely in terms of body weight changes, because you know, none of us, including every life form on the planet, would be here without metabolism, right? Metabolism is the thing that allows life to be. It's like this continuous flow of matter and energy that takes the food that we eat and the air that we breathe and basically drives every biological process in the body. And it's doing it in a very complicated way that's really beautiful. But, you know, high school students kind of hate it because they have to memorize all these enzymes and all these biochemical pathways. But at the end of the day, every one of those things is potentially costing energy. And so how do you take cell by cell, each individual biochemical and physiological process and a portion? Well, how many calories does that equal? None of us have really any idea. We know some of the big players like pumping ions across a cell membrane to create the difference in sodium and potassium. That costs a huge amount of energy. So that's probably a good chunk of the calorie expended even at rest. There's the turnover of protein. Breaking down proteins to amino acids costs a little bit of energy, but it costs a lot more to kind of put those amino acids together to make full proteins. That's going to cost a huge chunk of energy. But there's all sorts of other things that we don't really know how much is being allotted to each thing. And when you get a greater than expected change of metabolism, which one of those fundamental processes have changed and how are they rebalancing with each other? I don't think people have a good idea about that right now.
Some of the things we talked about, I remember a few years ago, you mentioned that most of these people still were burning a ton of calories from non-exercise activity thermogenesis, right? They were still burning on average. It's just their basal metabolic rate, what they would just burn while alive, was lower than expected. Is that right?
Yeah, because these folks were still, on average, doing quite a bit of physical activity, right? That's one of the things I think folks mistake. The folks who regained, you know, 2/3 of the lost weight, they're still down by about 12% of body weight on average 6 years afterwards. And on average, they're a lot more physically active than they were to begin with. At least they're spending a lot more calories on physical activity. But in fact, the ones who are most successful at keeping the weight off are now the most physically active compared to where they were at baseline. Yeah. And there was this kind of interesting correlation between the physical activity, the more physical activity that they had compared to baseline, the greater slowing of metabolism they continue to experience, which is kind of like the same sort of idea that Hermann Pontzer has popularized in some right. of his studies. But again, we don't know what the cause of, if that's causal, if that's just a correlation. Yeah. We don't know which components of energy expenditure might be most responsible for those trade-offs. So there's a lot of really interesting science to still be done in this area. So that's kind of where we are at this point.
And just to follow up another one, these people experience the most like reported metabolic adaptation compared to like bariatric surgery or other studies that have done this. And the thought was, maybe is it possible when these people went back to get remeasured, they were like, oh gosh, I better start dieting, because I know you need to be weight stable, because otherwise it can lower things at the same time even without a lot of weight loss or all that stuff.
Well that was the big adjust. Yeah, I mean, that was the big surprise, actually, because, you know, just taking a look at on average, when we measured these folks at the end of this weight loss competition, they're still trying to lose. They're still in active weight loss, right? In fact, that's probably their most active. They're like, they know they're coming back to Los Angeles. They're going to do the final weigh-in. They've like probably in that last few weeks had cut more calories and probably been doing more exercise than they had on average for the past, you know, several weeks. And so if anything, we thought that would be the greatest reduction in resting metabolic rate once you normalized for their fat mass and their fat-free mass. And yet at 6 years, even though now they'd gained on average 2/3 of the lost weight, and by the way, they regained the same proportion of fat-free mass and fat mass, so it's not like they gained disproportionately fat mass. On an absolute basis, their resting metabolic rate was, on average, the same as it was in the active weight loss phase when they were much lower in body weight, and even without normalization. So they're weight stable at 6 years because we sent them scales like for 2 weeks beforehand, and on average, they're not gaining or losing weight before they came to the NIH at 6 years. and their tooth, they've regained, you know, a huge chunk of their weight. So why is it that their resting metabolic rate was absolutely the same number as it was when they were in active weight loss, you know, quite a bit lower in body weight? It was like a complete mystery. I thought that we completely screwed the study up. And the only thing that we could think of that could be wrong was that maybe the metabolic cart that we used in the kind of active weight loss competition was different. And so we actually flew the metabolic cart from the Pennington Center that did those measurements in the first study to the NIH to see if it had been somehow miscalibrated, because we didn't believe the data. And they were basically giving the same results. So we couldn't help but say, you know what, as confusing as it is, this is what we saw. And like I said, we're beginning to understand maybe that there's this long-term relationship between long-term increases in physical activity and resting metabolic rate that, you know, Herman Ponser and folks have talked about. But it's very difficult to, you know, do these kinds of long-term studies, and there's no control group, and there's all sorts of caveats associated with that. It's really just a hypothesis at this point.
Very cool. All right. Do you have any follow-ups on that, Casey?
Well, I was just going to say, Julie, so how do we communicate that to patients? So in our world, you know, we talk a lot about the biology of weight regain being primarily driven by the biological processes that are kind of like your spring analogy or tug of war, pulling patients back up to a weight that's not so good for them based upon hunger signals, appetite signals, satiety, what people call food noise now. But the metabolic adaptation isn't the cause, but it's not helping their cause based upon what you're saying. Does that kind of right? And how would Julia say that?
Yeah, the way I think about it now is someone who struggled with weight and first looked to metabolism for an explanation about what was going on is that it's not metabolism, stupid. Don't look at your food environment first. Look at how easy is it for you to make meals that aren't going to kind of put you at a higher risk of weight gain. These are the things you talk about all the time. What's your lifestyle like? How supportive is your environment for being able to maintain the kind of changes you want to make? I think very often many of us who have struggled kind of look to basically, I think it's like, it's a way of, I don't know if it's like part of the blame that we do with weight, but it's a way to say, yeah, maybe it's a slow metabolism, maybe it's my genes. And I know you're asking on a patient level, not the population level. And I know, but I think it's still even though the way we think about environments is maybe more at the population level, I think it's still relevant to the patient. Because when I went through this experiment, at least, it was quite enlightening, like going through the genetic testing and the metabolic chamber and having all these things checked in myself, and then taking a really hard look at like what was my childhood food environment like. And it was both wonderful and catastrophic for someone who had a high genetic susceptibility to obesity, which I have. So I guess, but I don't know if that answered your question. You're thinking, yeah, like how to...
Well, kind of. I mean, I guess just, you know, when we talk to patients and we talk about why it's hard, I mean, we talk about how, you know, everyone's got a genetic predisposition. So that already sets up a wide variability amongst different people, even though on average, these are some of the data. So we know this on average, but everyone's actually really different. Some people seem to have a little bit better metabolic flexibility. And when I say that, not about like carbohydrate fat burning, like in some of the sciences, more like, you know, some of those changes that you mentioned, metabolic rate increase, decrease, to almost sort of balance things out. Kind of like that Seinfeld episode where he's like, yeah, it'll all even out for me. But some people seem to have that genetic predisposition that makes it sort of worse. But a lot of it is mostly driven by all these other appetite type signals and the energy intake, more so than the metabolic adaptation that's to some degree working against them. Right, Kevin?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, one of the things that we've been trying to do over the years is quantify the relative strength of like these feedback circuits that do make it difficult within a given environment for someone to, you know, use lifestyle to change their weight, right? Like the Biggest Loser is an example where, you know, people did remove themselves from their usual environment. They put themselves in this very artificial setting where lifestyle was not just encouraged, but you know, you were berated if you didn't kind of do the exercise or whatever it was, right? But for most people, I think the point is that when they kind of make the conscious choice, or they decide with the care of their physician or the trainer or dietitian or nutritionist to kind of make a change in their life, in a given environment, if that environment hasn't changed, yeah, they can exert some willpower. And one of the things we know is that people with obesity don't have obesity because of lack of willpower. The Biggest Loser folks kind of showed that, right? I mean, these folks had incredible amounts of willpower. But even in that environment, you can change some things for a period of time. In fact, some people are successful at it permanently, but the biology does resist that change. Like I said, the tension on the spring isn't determinative of how much weight you're going to lose. And if you cut the tension on the spring in some way, then you'd lose a lot more weight, but you're still facing that resistance. And what we've sort of learned over the years is that that metabolic side, the energy expenditure side of the equation, that's been the focus of so much attention, primarily because we could measure it relatively easily at the whole body level, is less important than the appetite side of the equation. And so when we tried to quantify, like, how much does appetite increase when people are losing weight versus how much does overall energy expenditure decrease, it's like more than threefold more, a greater response on the appetite side of the equation than it is on the expenditure side of the equation. At least those are kind of initial estimates on average. Probably varies from person to person, probably isn't necessarily a linear relationship or something like that. But I think focusing on the expenditure side has been maybe misleading to many folks, and focusing on metabolic slowing is determinative, but maybe it's this, it's the appetite side that's really important. And then it's not necessarily a surprise that some of the main most effective ways that we have to have people lose weight and keep it off seem to be most effective on addressing the appetite side of the equation.
I think Spencer and I often use in my clinic, just because I have to give talks on this all the time. Oh, where'd Julie go? I use slides looking at some of the trials on tirzepatide and semaglutide, specifically the ones that show all the participants were given the medication. They lose, 15 to 22% of their weight over 36 weeks or so, and then they're randomized to placebo or medication. They don't know the difference. They're still working on the diet and exercise that got them down to that weight. And then suddenly we see a change, and the placebo group regaining weight despite their continued efforts and thinking they're on the medication. And then, of course, continued weight loss on the medication. And not everyone regains the weight. Like you just said, some people, maybe it does just help them figure out their habits, and then their, what we call metabolic adaptation, or what all these different physiological processes aren't as difficult for them to be able to maintain it compared to some of the biological drive that's variable in other people who have more of that genetic predisposition or whatever else. You know, I say, yeah, you got these genetic things, and the monkey wrenches get thrown into it from our environment and life. And a lot of people see in us, they have different diseases and different medications and all these things working against them.
Absolutely.
Kevin, you recently did an analysis of bariatric surgery, semaglutide, and tirzepatide. And this patients always ask this, like, well, what happens when I plateau? Is it just not working anymore? And the way I describe it, and you can just tell everybody that's listening whether I'm wrong or not, is that, like, you have this biological drive to eat. It keeps, as you lose weight, that biological drive keeps going up, as you've mathematically shown in the past. And the medicine, as you go up, is pushing at a certain force, and at some point they match, and they're not going to lose any more weight. They're not going to gain any weight, but the biological drive of appetite is now matching the biological drive from the medicine to push back against it. And then it's not moving anywhere. Is that reasonable? Or you say, no, that's not exactly how it
works. Well, it's probably not exactly how it works, but I think that's a pretty good way to kind of describe it to someone. I mean, I think the point is that as people lose weight, the more weight that they lose, the greater and greater the battle is, right? So at some point, that initial dose of the drug, or after you've ramped up the dose of the drug and it's having its maximum effect, that's going to be like the fastest rate of weight loss that people see, is when it's having the maximum effect. But that doesn't mean that it's the effect is waning just because now weight loss is slowing because it having to kind of push a bigger and bigger thing up a hill, right? Is one way to mm-hmm. think about it, right? So it has a greater and greater battle to fight. And eventually that's your description is exactly right. At some point, the weight loss and the feedback to appetite is now matching what the drug can do. And so now if you remove the drug, then it's like, oh my gosh, I can't possibly maintain this, right?
Remain studies I just talked about, right? Yeah, I mean, I think it proves it to what you're saying, Spencer. I think I say the exact same thing. I mean, it's, you take the medicine away, you'll find out, unfortunately. And
right.
Yeah, I like that Boulder analogy. I'm going to use that.
In the past, I mean, I think that the point has been that, a lot of the lifestyle that people engage in, the same sort of thing is happening, right? So they put in a certain amount of effort to kind of cut the calories in their diet or go on a low carb diet or a low fat diet or some change in their lifestyle or start an exercise program. And the problem with those interventions for many people, not all people, has been that the amount that they see at the plateau is not what they wanted, right? It's like maybe 5% weight loss, which is clinically still beneficial to their, and same with exercise, right? People kind of have tied exercise to weight loss and it's having all these beneficial effects, but they look at the scale and they're like, oh man, this sucks. I'm not getting what I want. And especially when that plateaus, right? Especially because then they're like, they're not getting the positive feedback from their family anymore. It's like, oh yeah, you lost some weight. This is great. They're like, I wanted to lose like at least double what I've lost. Why am I even doing this anymore? And they think that it's not working. And so what's the point? But the point is that all that lifestyle in the effort that they're engaged in is still like holding that boulder, at the hill. And if they're not happy with how far they've rolled that boulder up the hill, then gosh, I guess I'm just gonna stop doing this. And I think that's why you start to see weight regain in a lot of people, or something in their social environment changes, right? Which is like, going through a divorce, I lost my job. They don't have like the right support system that they had in the past. And then again, you can't put in that same level of effort that you had in the past. And that's, again, one of the reasons why I think it's great to focus on the biology, but there's all this other environmental stuff that's going on, which is equally important to kind of determining whether or not people can stick to those lifestyle changes, whether the drugs are working on one background environment versus another background environment. That can be the food environment. It could be your social environment. And all that gets super complicated super quickly.
Well, I was just going to say that's a great point.
Your mouth.
Spencer, shut your mouth.
You shut your mouth.
You shut your mouth. It's a great, hold on though. Doing those lifestyle factors is good for people no matter what the weight is. That's why we talk about the health benefits of treating the clinical aspects of obesity. Diet, exercise improvements are good for you no matter what your weight does per se. That's it.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I was going to say that's a good segue. I mean, Julia's over in Paris right now, and we hear about, the food environment's so much better over there, and they have different additives and whatever. You've gotten into the whole ultra processed food studying and what the effect is on calorie consumption based on all that. I'd love to we don't have too much time to get into it, but especially because Julia's literally over in Paris right now and you're doing these studies. I'd love to hear your take on the difference between here and Europe and all that stuff.
The carbs are healthier there, right?
Absolutely, yes. Especially the croissant. They're excellent for weight loss. The biggest difference I notice in Paris, and I'm trying to figure out if this is like how true this is for the rest of France. I have traveled a little bit in the country, but I know obviously Paris. I know Paris the most intimately. And it's this ubiquitous availability everywhere of healthy prepared foods. So there's, it's quite easy. So the French really prioritize having fresh meals. And there's like a big thing. If you go to a restaurant at 12 o'clock, it's empty. If you go between 12, like if you sit there at 12, there's like no one there. 12:30, it starts to fill up. By 1 o'clock, it's full. So there's a very highly regimented approach to eating here. Like the goûter, the snack for kids is 4:30, depending on when they get off of school. It's not this like eating all the time. So they have like a very regimented social approach to eating. It means something to sit down to a meal. And so it's not like the eating in your car. I was talking to a French researcher the other day who said she was amazed because she was visiting the US and there was a power outage. And it was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It wasn't a meal time or what she would think of as a meal time. And the answer was, let's just order a pizza. And she was like, what's going on here? Why would you eat a pizza at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? It's not dinner time. But the way what this the related thing is that so people really prioritize fresh food and cooking, but people work really hard. And in Paris, it's often like in many parts of the world and in the US, it's two people in a family working, right? Like two people and a couple are working. And so they really value still being able to access this like healthy prepared foods. So one of the first, I had a little bit of French from Canada, like Kevin maybe, but one of the first words I learned here was traiteur, which is caterer. Because every second store here is like this place where you could walk in and you can buy a roast chicken, potatoes, green beans, whatever it is. And there's this brand, grocery store brand that you walk into and everything is frozen. All the stuff is in freezers, but it's like there's variability, but it's a lot of healthy frozen options. Mm. So I find that quite interesting, but you have, I think like, yeah, they've done little things in policy and regulation to preserve this food culture. Like, so the other big thing in Paris is in every arrondissement, in every district, you have lots of fresh open air markets. So even if you do want to cook, you can get the fresh ingredients very easily. So I don't know, that gives you an overview, but at the same time on my street, for example, there's cookie stores, there's like lots of different bakeries, there's chocolatier, there's like 50 chocolatiers within like a stone's throw from my apartment. So the junk food is here too, but I think it's this like regimented approach to eating that's a little bit different, and the availability of just being able to easily access healthy prepared options.
So culturally,
it's called chocolate junk food.
I know.
It's culture. There's a cultural thing. Kevin, you're doing the studies on this, and you know we're not going to talk about all of them because that's what the book's for. But do you think there's a difference between the foods here and over in Europe, or is it a cultural thing? What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I think that when we talk about the food environment and its really important role, at least, you know, the case that we make in the book is that it's the changes in the food environment that have driven the increases in the prevalence of diet-related chronic disease in every country, and the ones that have resisted it the most, like France and Japan, often have these very regimented kind of food cultures that have been resistant to much of the changes that have happened in countries like the UK and Canada and the US. And so one of the things that we were interested in is, you know, there's all sorts of factors in the food environment. It's like how easy it is to kind of prepare the foods, how much does it cost, how much equipment and skill do you need? What is it? Is there anything about the foods themselves, right? And so the studies that we did at the NIH when I was there, we removed many of those cultural aspects or aspects to do with the food environment involved, like expense and time commitments and things like that, and just asked questions like, if we presented people with just, they don't have to do anything, they get three meals a day. In one of the studies, we got snacks, and another one, they didn't get snacks, but we presented them with way more calories than they would need, and we matched multiple diets for like nutrients. Would people choose to eat more calories of a diet that was very high in these so-called ultra-processed foods, or a diet that that had none of these ultra-processed foods, despite having the same opportunity to consume more calories? And the answer was, despite getting rid of all of the cost and time commitment issues and cooking and all those sorts of things, there seemed to be something about the foods themselves that drove people to, without trying, they're given really simple instructions. Don't be trying to gain or lose weight. Just eat as much or as little as you'd like. They actually reported that the meals were equally pleasant. So it wasn't that they just liked the ultra processed foods anymore. But for whatever reason, they consumed on average in our first study about 500 calories per day more than they did when the minimally processed diet. They spontaneously gained weight and gained body fat on the ultra processed diet, whereas the same folks would just lose weight and lose body fat on the minimally processed diet. And we were able to reproduce that in a follow-up study and then start to investigate what are the properties of these overall meals that might be driving this effect. And we're sort of getting at like trying to understand the mechanisms of how the foods themselves might cause overeating. And so that's kind of what some of the science is. And then, but on top of that, in the real world, you have all these other things like the ultra processed meals in America and Canada. They're the most heavily marketed. They're available everywhere. They're convenient. You don't need any, you know, equipment or to you know, store them or cook them or skill to do those sorts of things. And most people, you know, they're not necessarily gourmet meals in Paris, but they're pretty tasty, right? And your kids don't reject them very often. And so all those other factors, I think, are also playing a role in how frequently we sort of overconsume calories, given that the foods themselves then tend to have this property.
One thing I've been thinking about a lot here is how we talk about culture like it's this magical, it is this like ephemeral thing that's sort of hard to pin down, and where does it come from and how do you perpetuate it? But what I've seen here is that they use regulation and policy to support a certain culture. It doesn't happen by accident. So there's, I think it might be through land use. There's restrictions on the size of supermarkets in Paris, and that has this effect of preserving the fresh market tradition. Hmm. There's regulation and rules about what you can feed kids in school, in public schools. I think private schools are not governed by these. There's all these little nudges, right? Paris has this 15-minute city. Sorry, there it is. It's between the 15-minute city concept, where most of your amenities you can reach by foot or active transport within 15 minutes. And then it's not just this accident of history. They've done a lot to preserve this walkability and kind of get, if the listeners love SUVs, they do not love them in Paris. You have to pay a fortune to drive and park an SUV in Paris. So they, you know, it's not an accident. And I think this is also what we argue in the book, that these levers, these policy regulatory levers, need to be pulled in order to move the culture in a better direction in the US.
So yeah. You're saying we need to get our politicians to actually agree and not be divisive with each other? Okay, good. That'll be easy.
Yeah, I know. Saying it is the easy part, right? And doing it is... Yeah.
So Spencer, here, I know we're getting out of time, but I would love for them to maybe, maybe come up with some points of each of the different chapters in the book as like teasers for people. In some way, maybe you know how to ask that better because you probably
know. No, however many listeners,
a little like high level stuff, because we want people to read the book as homework.
Everybody listening should be reading this book.
I actually want to push back on one of the things that Dr. Carl just said, right? Because
oh dear God,
in fact, one of the things that was rare in this last sort of election season was that you had Democrats and Republicans saying exactly the same thing when it came to our food. You know, Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker, RFK Jr., several, you know, Republican senators were saying all the same things. Mm-hmm. And we did have a period like that. And there's a section of our book called Purer Food about the policies and regulations that around the turn of the 20th century, when we were also worried about processed foods killing people, but we were worried about acute food poisoning. And we had a scientist named Harvey Wiley who did these really incredible studies trying to figure out, you know, what dose of borax will actually cause like physical harm to people, because people were using like formaldehyde and borax and all sorts of things to try to preserve their food. And the manufacturers were using these to kind of preserve food, and they weren't required to put them on labels or anything. Mm. And it was a groundswell of kind of activity that was bipartisan that finally forced the government to start to make changes. And in fact, this was the dawn of the Pure Food and Drug Act, which was the beginning of the FDA, an actual agency of the federal government that was going to start regulating food. We actually have that same sort of opportunity now. If we actually, you know, we have like this broad bipartisan support to address, you know, our food. And I think that we could actually make a lot of headway on that if we kind of had the right folks with the right messaging that weren't being divisive. And I think that that's one of the reasons why, you know, people need to be educated about that. This isn't all just about willpower. It's also probably not about food dyes either, or replacing, right, you know, high fructose, yes, corn syrup with cane sugar. But, you know, at least the motivations, yeah, seem to be right, at least among, yeah, the grassroots folks. And so, yeah, we talk a lot about the importance of that and having, you know, common ground and some of the things that people can start to think about and push their elected representatives on, because it is a bipartisan issue.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The concept is absolutely bipartisan. It's all those other into the weeds and policy things, yeah, that are frustrating. So
do you think a big food thing? Like, do we just, do you have, yes, to, like, I don't know.
Yeah,
it's do, big food. Do we have to fight big food?
Well, you're going to have to fight big food on this, right? I mean, they're not, as Marion Nestle likes to say, they're not, you know, public health or organizations. They're, yeah, there to make a profit, and they're going to resist everything that any government tries to do to put any regulations or policies in place. And that's their job. Doesn't mean, mm-hmm, that we give up. It means that, yeah, you push, yeah, them, right? And and that's how it's going to work. I mean, that's how you get change in any sort of system. But I think that the momentum is there now. I mean, and the kind of bipartisan support is there now. I mean, it's one of the differences between what's true now that was not true when Michelle Obama did her Let's Move campaign, right? Then it was clearly partisan. Republicans were like, this is nanny state politics. We can't have this. But times have changed. Now you have Republicans and Democrats saying the same thing when it comes to food. It just, we've got some of the wrong people in place that to actually act on this.
So yeah, I think one thing we do, and we're very excited about doing in the book, is tracing like all these crazy ideas we have about nutrition. Why is there this obsession with protein maximization? Why is one of the most divisive battle zones of the diet wars about which level of carbs and fats you should be eating to lose weight or maintain a healthy body weight? We trace where all, like, this deep history of where these ideas come from. And then obviously we eventually unpack what they actually mean for individual decision making and what we know now. So I think that's a fun part of the book. And I'm really excited about also the food environment piece of it, because I think it's something we still are under this illusion that we have this full control over every morsel we're putting in our mouths. And the latest science shows that that's definitely not the case, and that the food environment has a much greater influence than many of us realize. And so we unpack that wonderful science in the book as well.
Very good. Well, I'm excited. I think actually the publisher is sending me a hard copy. I know you sent me a PDF, cool, at one point. So I'm going to be shilling it all over my Instagram and making sure everybody, all my patients, I'm sure my brother will do the same, to get this if they're interested in.
Very kind.
Yeah, no, wow.
Well, Kevin, we appreciate having a very good evidence-based, rational book out there, because of all the, you know, most of the books out there, they're just trying to sell based on extremism, all the things it's that you guys are, you know, trying to explain and articulate why those are the things. And yeah, and it's frustrating because people, you know, they really bank on it. And then we have to.
And we actually show that, you know, that actually has a long history in nutrition science as well. I mean, it's kind of interesting how this kind of keeps recurring, people, mm-hmm, having these interesting but not particularly correct theories, and then they trot these solutions out to the public and misinform them about the level of certainty that they have, and it just keeps happening over and over again. And so hopefully by reading our book, they'll, you know, people will kind of be able to spot this and be able to kind of understand that this is par for the course. This is what people do right now. It's, you know, about supplements and wellness products and what kinds of things to avoid in your diet and protocols and whatnot. And it's the same sort of pattern, right? You have some sciencey sounding theory and you don't really have any desire to test your theory, but you have a great desire to promote your theory as the basis for why your wellness hack is going to lead to all these positive things. And some people do experience positive things, but for the most part,
the ubiquity, the fire hose of these claims now, it's just completely overwhelming. I was doing a thought experiment when Kevin was talking about the early Biggest Losers research and how, like, the botched reporting of it. What would it be like in the TikTok and like Instagram? I don't know. What do you think the reporting would be like now?
Dear Lord.
I have a theory, but.
Well, I remember it was big on Facebook, and everybody was like, see, they're metabolically damaged. They trash their metabolisms. And that's why I was friends with Kevin at the time. And I kept coming back going, no, I just literally talked to the guy who did this. This is this. I mean, it was very tough because it's not like I did the study. I did then tell everybody what Kevin communicated to me. It was tough.
Yeah, and it wasn't just social media. It was like amongst our medical colleagues trying to learn it too. It was, I think everyone kind of got it, but it, got presented not always exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I have a theory that it would probably be like you would have people like yourself who are trying to do this more nuanced, evidence-based discussion, and then you'd have the other side of, and then most of it would probably be the extreme other side.
It's hard to meet them.
Nuance doesn't sell. I can tell you that for free from Kevin's brother in martyrism.
Martyrdom. It's martyrdom.
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 Martyrdom. We're martyrs, and that's
martyrdom. No, Kevin, we're going to get Kevin to shill out for big industry at some point here. Now he's not a government.
Let's go for it. We
need to get paid. Yeah, I actually have this dream of making a lot of money through my clinic and building a whole metabolic ward just for him. That's my goal. Our dumb little thing.
Maybe one of these days people will realize the importance of doing this kind of science, and we'll be able to kind of start something where we can actually get answers to these questions.
I'm glad.
We appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. Food Intelligence. It's out. Well, we're going to release this right before it comes out. That's 23rd. Is that right? September 23rd. So everybody should go buy it. You can follow Julia Belews on X, Twitter, anywhere else.
Where else am I? I'm on Substack. I'm on Instagram. I'm around. I'm hanging out in different places. Yeah, Kevin, not everywhere, but a few. Yeah.
Kevin, you're on X still. Still surviving on X somehow. Somehow.
Fighting the good fight.
Yeah, God. Anywhere else you want to promote?
Yeah, I have a website now. KevinHallPhD.com.
Oh, there it is.
Can you imagine that?
Funded. Awesome. Funded by... By Big Sugar and Big Pizza, and yeah, I'm just kidding, everybody.
Definitely pizza. Definitely big pizza.
Very good. Well, thank you all for coming on. And here is our outro. Make sure you share this with somebody confused about some of these myths about the Biggest Loser study and where to find an awesome book that goes over all this data. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.